Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience, molecular biology, law and public affairs, and Princeton Election Consortium.
So if you thought 2018 was going to be calmer than 2017, you were wrong.
Oh, God.
The year has started off with all kinds of chaos and controversy and tweets and just everything you could imagine. The last few days have been shaped by Memogate and the controversy over the memo that the House Intelligence Committee under Congressman Nunez released that suggests that the FISA warrant on Carter Page for his connections with Russia was based on information from Christopher Steele, who was a former intelligence agent, but then working to collect intelligence and dirt on President Trump's campaign, that this means the entire investigation is corrupt. There are more memos to come. All sorts of figures are going to pop up. This was very controversial, the release of the memo, the fact the memo was, by most accounts, skewed and misleading and incomplete. The president supported this. It's unclear what he's going to do with the Democratic response. But it has, I think, you know, it's going to foster a lot of skepticism and distrust about everything from the FBI to Robert Mueller to the president. Whatever your perspective, it just creates a bad air. And so Sam and I wanted to talk a little bit about this and the implications and what all this does to our government institutions a year into President Trump.
Let's say the big thing first, yeah, which is that the goal of misinformation, like this cloud of, I have to say about half of the claims you said there, as far as I can tell, you were very faithful in saying what the claims were. But half of those claims are either arguable or false.
Yep.
And I think what's going on here is this thing that's come up over and over again where in order to discredit the truth, you don't have to get people to believe the false thing. You just have to make things confusing so that people have a little bit of trouble discerning the truth. And mass media in the United States seems to be still struggling with how to deal with false statements that are made. So let's think about this one a little bit. So, right, because it's just, you know, the administration says X, and that would be a fairly conventional thing to do with administration statements, whether it be from Nixon or Reagan or Clinton or Obama. That's what you do, right? Like people in the news report.
Maybe not Nixon, but yeah.
Well, no, but even, no, okay, know, right, right. Like, but even, right, like, you know, say when it's like agricultural policy
with
Nixon, like, you know, not like, you know, H.R. Haldeman stuff, but like, you know, like boring policy stuff. The idea is the administration says X and we're going to report on it and maybe something needs correction. But here, this is this cloud of falsehood, right? So this memo says that maybe some of it came from the Steele dossier. But, you know, I don't know, in 2013, this Carter Page character was bragging about how he was a Kremlin operative. So I don't know. That seems relevant. A bunch of FBI people investigating these things are registered Republicans. Also seems relevant. And so, you know, I don't know, like I have yet to hear anything that in that famous Steele dossier that checks as being false. I'm not hearing anything about that. So surely if there's something in that dossier that checked out as false, we'd be hearing a lot about that. And so it's just this cloud of like, oh, there's a memo and it's like a butter emails kind of moment. Yeah. Like, have you read the Nunes memo? Well, you know, I don't know. It seemed okay.
I think you're right. Everyone was focused or still is focused on this Saturday night massacre potential. So, you know, when is the moment President Trump, if he did try to fire Robert Mueller and tries to end the investigation like Nixon did with Archibald Cox in October of 73? But I think a bigger part of the strategy is what you're actually saying. He doesn't need to fire him. I think the goal is just to discredit the entire thing and sow enough confusion and doubt that this is legitimate. So by the time you hit that point, either people will be fine, fire him, or it doesn't even matter. Because ultimately, everyone's expecting this is going to be handled legally, where the reality is it's a political issue. It will be dealt with in Congress most likely.
Right.
That's still the odds. And if you can keep Republicans on your side, and if you can create doubts about the legitimacy of the investigation, which more Republicans now believe, from what I've seen, there are more people raising questions about the investigation itself.
But there's also Republican legislators who are saying that, in fact, the investigation seems okay. So there,
right, including one who wrote the memo.
Gowdy.
I don't know where he is on this at this point. I mean, I think that's part of the confusion.
Well, but his public statements so far are that the investigation is legit and everything seems okay. I mean,
Let's see.
I think broadly speaking, it's going to be something like what it's going to turn into is partisanship and choosing up sides until somebody's ox gets gored, until losses happen at the ballot box. And so if there's a giant spanking at the elections in, you know, in November 2018, like this fall, if there's a giant spanking by voters of the Republican Party and they suffer tremendous losses, I think that's going to create a rethinking. I mean, like, I hate to put it
that's
politically.
That's the only way it happens.
As opposed to, let's say our philosopher king, we're sitting on the mountain. We say, what is it that should be true in a just society? The FBI should be the guardian of law and order, and we should put our trust in the FBI. So that kind of idealist thinking is not quite what's at play here. Right. I mean, let me paint this scenario.
Yeah.
It's going to be something like this. Stipulate that you're right, that the FBI is not going to be leading a political prosecution of the president of the United States, but they are going to be prosecuting people who are criminals, people who helped with the obstruction of justice, people who worked with an adversary of the United States, things like that. Those people are subject to prosecution. We've already seen this Papadopoulos character Manafort is under prosecution. So that's, you know, that's something that's very much within the province of the FBI.
Yes.
So the where the ball is on the field is to undermine the rule of law and to prevent Mueller from prosecuting these people who may be criminals. And so that's where things are at. And then, you know, there's this long game, which is you know, did the president of the United States collude with, you know, foreign forces?
I just feel that some of this campaign is going to work better than some suspect. Meaning the camp.
You think
there'll be a lot of Republican voters and even non-Republicans who at least have something in their head that, boy, there's this secret memo and it was released and there's doubts.
Must
about
be something there.
And it's
like Hillary's emails.
It's the same thing. And the amount of coverage, I mean, the buildup to the memo is more important than it didn't matter what was in the memo.
The thing that was produced was like a big storm and drung, and then a little mouse came out.
But the mouse doesn't matter by that point because it's received so much coverage and so much discussion. And now there's more, several more memos are coming. And this is a strategy the president keeps employing and the Republicans keep employing, not just with the investigation, but with lots of issues. It's a strategy of confusion and doubt. And it is intentionally, we started it with the rigged election argument back when he was still running, and we're seeing it today, or the media, his attacks. The point is you don't know what's up and what's down, the gaslighting theory, whatever you want to call it. And I think that's what's going on right now. This is the Saturday Night Massacre you're watching. I don't think a firing is necessarily going to be the culmination. It's already in process.
Because you can just undermine the whole institution.
Sure. If no one believes Mueller by the time this comes out, or not no one, but a sizable part of his own needed support, he's won. And, if you look at the memo.
We need a new name for this.
It's amazing. The memo, if you look, it's a partisan document. That's all. It's not a memo.
Right.
Even that term. It is a partisan document with some very select points that clearly don't cover the majority of what was found and what was driving this. But yet it gets reported as a memo and there needs to be a Democratic rebuttal. It almost gets this legitimacy.
Well, the Senate and House Intelligence Committees traditionally don't have Democratic and Republican memos. They don't have a majority report and a minority report. They're supposed to come together. And that's been the case for decades, right? It's sort of this Cold War consensus where there is a question of getting to the bottom of things and gathering information. And, this includes things like the 9/11 Commission, right, where one is supposed to transcend politics. And here, this has all gotten dragged into the muck, where now the Democrats have released a 10-page document, which, if I'm understanding correctly, is evidently too long for Donald Trump to read, which, actually, I find that believable. Yeah, all right, 10 pages is too long to read. Maybe put it on a teleprompter and he can read it aloud.
Right.
Cryon. Right, because
see a lot of crying.
Because his State of the Union speech was like this record,
yeah.
This phone book sized thing.
Right.
So why not put it in a teleprompter? Maybe he can read that. But yeah, it's the idea that there are facts to be gotten to the bottom of is starting to get blurred a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, there is healthy distrust of institutions. One of the themes, certainly since President Trump became president, of commentators is what are the risks of a president who fuels this kind of distrust? And it's the same with Putin, which is what he wants to do. And I always think instantly, well, some distrust is okay. That was the lesson of the 60s and early 70s. David Garrow, the civil rights historian, has a big op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that he's critical of liberals, that liberals are going overboard to be positive about the FBI and ignoring the long history of all the stuff the FBI does. This is the biographer of Martin Luther King, so this is always on his mind. But this seems to – I think we have to distinguish between a healthy skepticism and a distrust to what we're seeing now, which is a scorched earth. Nothing's real. Nothing is provable. And no institution of government can really be considered either legitimate or trustworthy or accountable.
Well, let's take the long arc here. So maybe liberals are saying that the FBI is okay. Although I'm not sure that's entirely true. It's more along the lines of this appears to be a legitimate investigation that is being undermined by extra legal forces. And so, like, but to just step back a little bit, there's a long arc here. Yeah. The long arc is that people are losing faith in institutions, whether it be medical institutions, political institutions, right. Unions, whatever politicians, obviously all across America, the corporations. Loss of faith in institutions is a big story arc of the last half century.
Yes.
And here we are now at a point where that is a weapon that can be used in politics. And it's been a weapon that can be used in politics. And now it's right up front where, okay, you're distrustful of institutions. Well, guess what? The FBI, which I know you were saying it was a great institution to hold down people you didn't like. Well, now it's something not to be trusted. And so it feels like it's part of this just continuing degradation, frankly, of public life and of things that hold the country together. And I don't want to get too melodramatic about it, but it's a little worrisome.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think it's bleeding into many institutions. And that's why it's not simply the FBI. The FBI is a proxy in this case for a bigger argument.
The deep state.
And it's the deep state argument. Right. But ironically, to Garrow's point, that is an argument. Versions of it you can find in liberal ideas as well, progressive history. Certainly in the 1960s, a lot of this kind of argument came out and is now being appropriated in a different way.
Well, sure. It's in the culture and people know about it. And so it's easy to name check that stuff, like whether wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr. or what have you, right?
Yeah.
Or like sending him hate mail and trying to get him to kill himself. Those things were true. And in the fullness of time, those turned out to be true. In this case, it's little things like two FBI agents sending frivolous, facetious text messages to one another saying, oh, the secret meeting's later. An obvious joke. And then this brilliant senator, Ron Johnson, says, oh, it's signs of collusion. And it's just, wow, just really? We're at a point where a United States senator can like take a joke text message and then it gets blown up. And so here we are in an age where technology and things get amplified. Technology allows messages to be amplified. And some little butterfly wing movement of one SMS text message from one agent to another, like horsing around, because you have to like kill the time at work when, you make friends with people at work and you say a funny thing about the secret meeting and it goes public.
Yeah.
And then a United States senator says, there's a cabal.
Yeah.
And that's just, I find that insane.
No, I agree. But why do you think the Republicans – I don't know the answer. So the obvious answer, why are the Republicans in the House doing this? So why would the head of the Intelligence Committee basically go along with this effort to protect the president or to stop an investigation or undercut an investigation? Is it that they're just that supportive of their party because of polarization? Is it a belief that Trump is good for the party? Is it – There's another theory out there that a lot of Republican legislators are implicated in something. There must be some kind of self-interest involved.
What's going on? But there's that saying, it's not a conspiracy if they all think alike, right?
Yeah.
So it's more, I think
They were hawks on Russia, a lot of the GOP.
Yeah, but I think a reasonable explanation would be if you're an elected official, then there are certain ideals and goals that you have.
Yeah.
And but in order to reach any of those goals, you have to survive politically. And what is the – if we just imagine the choice situation, if the choice is the president of your party stays in office no matter how dirty or, you know, or unsavory his acts are versus him not in office, which is worse for you? And even though Trump's approval ratings are still floating around 35 or 40%, about 80% of Republicans at a minimum are on his side. And so if 80% of your primary voters are on your side, that's who you have to face in the primary, then you know what? Then you are a little bit better off sticking with him than not sticking with him. And at some point that calculus changes. It either changes when he loses support among from his own party, or it changes if the national temperature changes enough that something really bad happens in people from close districts. And so the presence of close districts, whether it be John Faso in New York or Leonard Lance in New Jersey or wherever these people might be, the calculus is not having to do with love of institutions, love of country, or keeping, you know, keeping the things that we love about our nation. The calculus is, geez, I got to make it through the next election.
Right.
And the way I'm going to do that is I got to get through the primaries here in the first quarter of or the first half of 2018. And the way I do that is I do not antagonize Trump supporters. So it's something like that. And so until an election happens that changes that, then political survival dictates that they stick with the one who is at the top of their party.
And I think that the other part of it, I know about it and I've written about it, but the importance of the conservative media, I think, is becoming, for me at least, more pronounced than the power it has.
Yeah.
And that's from Fox to Breitbart to any of the Alex Jones, you know, the whole range of media.
My students love to talk about Alex Jones.
But it's an incentive. it's probably hard in some ways to resist the temptation of throwing this kind of stuff out there to just make problems go away for you and from your party. And it
throw up chaff and people get confused by the chaff and maybe it'll go away.
And it's a combination of the mainstream media, which doesn't know how to report on this. I think you're right. And I think legitimately it's confusing sometimes. Like, do you just say this is just not true?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Sarah Sanders just lied. What do we do?
Right.
Right.
And
right.
Then to the conservative, if you watch Fox, it's kind of amazing how they repeat the storyline meticulously. And I think that's a bigger part of politics. It's not simply reporting on politics. It's really shaping the politics. And I think it creates incentives for members of Congress because you knew if you threw this out or talked about a memo – that story would be out there. So it works. And it's hard to contain that instinct in politics.
Are we going
to
see the Democratic half of the Intelligence Committee, are we going to see that memo? See, I said Democratic Party, so I'm sucked into it myself. But are we going to see that intelligence memo at some point?
I'm surprised they just haven't somehow.
Why don't they just dump it?
No, I actually thought, why not at this point?
Yeah.
I think we're going to learn what's in it. I think we already – a lot of what's in it is probably out there. The response to the Republican memo, which again, you're right, it's just incredible. We're now talking about the Intelligence Committee's the party split on what they're reporting on. The rebuttal has been out there. It's pretty clear, but I don't think it will change anything. Like, is this Democratic memo really going to convince many people who are skeptical of the investigation?
No, because people have prior thoughts about what's true and false. But just to step back a little bit,
mind? You're an expert of the mind. I mean, is it possible to do that in this political world? Can you persuade?
We all have models about how the world works.
Yeah,
and we keep out things that don't fit, and we assimilate the things that fit. That's called biased assimilation, and people do that. So you know, and the funny thing about this whole thing, just to step back from this whole little cloud of idiocy surrounding these memos, is that as far as I can tell, all the kind of bad things that were suspected to be true have more or less come true or turned out to be true. For example,
like
asking Comey for loyalty. Wow, yeah. that happened. Asking Rosenstein for loyalty. That happened. Making aspersions about, I don't know, was it McCabe's wife losing her political race? And so here's Trump doing exactly what you imagine he might be doing. Lower down political operatives being in contact with Russia and at first lying about why they were in contact. And eventually it turns out that they're drooling over the possibility of getting dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russians. And so all these things that sound like they're out of some bad spy novel or political thriller And as far as I can tell, they're all basically checking out the whole idea of A, collusion with Russia, and B, working to obstruct justice by interfering with the investigation. I'm not sure that any of that stuff has turned out to be false. There might be some small detail that turns out not to be true, but it's all pretty well supported. And as I said, as much as people like to complain about this memo by this Steele guy, I don't know. I'm not hearing anything. You know, there might be some small detail that's not true. I'm sure we'll hear about that. But the weird thing is that as bad as we can imagine it, all the bad things that we can imagine are checking out.
They're checking out, but they're also not really creating outrage, which is President Trump's bet. So you know he did this, and so he says, whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's the whatever politics. Yeah. Whatever. I will do what I want, and no one's going to hold me accountable, or no one will be as outraged as reporters think they will be. And so far, I mean, yes, his approval ratings have been bad, although they seem to be going up. He has the corporate tax cut. As we record this, the Senate announced a 2-year budget deal.
Oh, is that out?
And I bet you there will be an immigration deal in the near future that Democrats are not going to find their way out of. So he's starting to rack up some victories. And so maybe the calculation is you can attack institutions. You can do all this stuff. There is you could kind of talk, have people in your campaign connected. No one cares.
So some of the unpopularity before was just lack of legislative productivity. And so now that there's some giant tax cut for rich people and corporations, well, I don't know. Like I know you're telling me that it's only good for rich people. But anyway, hey, he got something done.
Right.
And so the idea is that that something is happening. Yeah, I think part of it is that we don't have concrete data other than opinion polling, which is kind of maddening. And I've been really keeping an eye on special elections, where there's this constant drip of special elections.
Yes.
That over the last 12 months has been a median of about 11 or 12 points towards away from the Republicans and towards the Democrats. And I think that, to my thinking, that's the only really concrete data we have. As we record this next week, there's going to be something like half a dozen special elections in the second week of February. And I think actually maybe 5 special elections. And so it's going to be more data. And so I'm keeping an eye on that just to see, are things, you know, what's actually happening? Because I think it's easy to hyperventilate over a 1 to 2 point movement in the polls. And yeah, things, you know, support for Congress, Republicans in Congress, and support for President Trump are ticking up a couple of points. But, you know, the long game is what's happening in those special elections. And, and it's not a happy trajectory for the Republicans. But, you know, yeah, it could be less unhappy. That's certainly possible.
Well, it will be unhappy for Republicans, because they always are the midterms, meaning other than a few exceptions, midterms go poorly for the party of the president. So the real question is just how bad it goes. Are we talking turnover of the House? Yeah. Are we talking about smaller?
But look, the early evidence from, you know, like, you know, when animals stampede, like, you know, trust the wisdom of the animals. And if you look at like legislators retiring, a lot of Republican animals are going for the exits. And look in Pennsylvania, where the gerrymandering case just is mostly resolved at this point. You know what? There's like a record number of retirements there. Like there's 6 open seats there. 10 committee chairmen, I think, by the most recent count, in the 10 Republican committee chairmen are leaving office. They're committee chairmen. They're supposed to be powerful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we can talk all we want about like opinion polls and little ticks up and down. But the animals who can smell the danger are leaving the forest.
Right now, in February, they're leaving the forest.
Yeah, but they have to make commitments. They got to make plans in the future.
I understand.
You got to get, you know, if you want the sweet lobbying gig, or if you want to be a commentator in ABC like Chris Christie or what have you, like, you know, you want your job afterwards.
Yeah.
Right? And so these people are planning for the future just as we all do.
Of course. And I was talking to someone, though. I was on a show and we were talking about this, and they pointed out, just in terms of President Trump, which was an interesting perspective I hadn't heard, that even if the Democrats do well and even if the Democrats take over Congress, it might work in his favor, because then he has an enemy in Congress that he can use, you know, the Nancy Pelosi image of the Democrats. Yeah. It will give him, like Clinton and Gingrich, someone to focus. So
I guess so. But, you know, that the House can also use its investigatory power to get its tax returns. I mean, if they're in the majority, they can control the agenda.
Right.
So what can they do? They can start passing popular legislation. They can start investigating these offenses.
Yeah.
So I
don't know. I'm a mixed mind, but I don't think it's inevitable.
Okay, but that's but there's political and then there's substantive. And the substantive power of the lower chamber of Congress is that they have responsibilities and they have power and they can exercise that. And if they're a co-equal branch of government, then guess what? They can pass out articles of impeachment. You know, I'm just going to be high-minded for a second and say, if indeed there were offenses that endanger the United States, then they should just, as a matter of principle, vote for those articles of impeachment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just saying hypothetically, purely hypothetically. Let's say that obstruction of justice and undermining of American democracy are considered offenses, which, you know—
Maybe they won't be in a few months. So
we're getting back to the lull, nothing matters view of our nation. Oh,
I didn't mean to depress. I want to get back to something you were just talking about. Put aside your gerrymandering and polarization cap. To your other cap, is like in terms of the mind and the bias, is it possible to persuade people to support things or to see things in a way that fundamentally, you know, clash with their pre-existing views?
It is possible, but the ways that have been effective aren't the way we interact with news media. So, for instance, one way to do it is to get people to consider the opposite. Imagine if you had heard that Barack Obama had fired an FBI official who was overseeing an investigation. Uh-huh. How would you feel? And any Republican would be just hair on fire. Like they'd be stockpiling ammo or something. And so one way to persuade people is to say, look, consider the opposite. Imagine if somebody you didn't like politically was doing it. How would you feel about it? So that's a thing that can work, but it requires a certain level of thoughtfulness that is really hard to achieve in any kind of broadcast media, any kind of mass communication. So that's something that has been shown to work to persuade people. The difficulty is that people have a powerful prior opinion. Now, it turns out that I think that the Comey firing was an example of a situation in which there were a lot of law and order types, not the TV show, but just, you know, people who are in favor of law and the rule of law, who were pretty conservative, and they respect what the FBI does. And for them, firing Comey was something really bad. And so that fundamental fact was persuasive. And now what we're seeing is backtracking of that. So if we look something that would work, if you look at principled conservatives who have bolted from where the Republican Party is right now, they are certainly skeptical about what's going on. They're pretty negative about it. Bill Kristol, and there's David Frum, Tom Nichols. These are people who are saying those things. And so if we think, okay, so what's an institution where the prior expectation is to believe that institution on the right? It would be the military. And so were the military, I mean, I really hate to go there because we're supposed to be in a civilian country, but were military figures to say this endangers the security of the nation, that is something that people would turn to, getting back to institutions where your prior expectation is you believe that person.
Yeah.
If General Mattis says something, or if the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says something, then your prior might be to trust that institution. If religious leaders, I mean, you know, I don't think this is really going to happen, but like if evangelical leaders, I mean, as I say it, this is definitely not going to happen. But if evangelical leaders were to say, our nation is in mortal danger. So I think something like that, basically relying on people's prior biases and saying, that's an entity that I can believe.
So that's interesting. So the only way for real change to happen in politics...
Okay, so
switching people's opinions would be in some ways to find divisions within one camp and play them against each other, because that's basically what you're saying. The only way to really shatter the consensus is to get the experts to disagree, the experts you agree with, the military to say this is dangerous, or evangelical Christian leader to say, you know, this guy's morals don't hold. That's the only way. Otherwise, most people will tend to stay where they are.
Yeah. Or as I said, a matter of, in the case of elected officials, a matter of political survival. Right.
Yeah.
And so, so that, these, you know, you didn't like my consider the opposite thing where appeal to people's higher angels and say that's too hard.
I can't imagine that working in politics.
No, I know, but I'm just saying that.
I feel like that is the strategy often of Democrats. So that is in some ways the reasonable or rational, disciplined appeal to the opposition to change your mind and think about how you would feel. But I think the second point you're making, if you map it out politically, is probably much more plausible.
Well, it's gonna be,
or for Republicans. I mean, it would work either way.
Makes me think to a different age when Adlai Stevenson was a political rally when he was running for president. You know, somebody said, Governor Stevenson, every thinking American supports you. Uh-huh. And his response was, it's not enough. I need a majority.
Right.
And so it's kind of like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's probably not going to happen. So in some ways, President Trump and the Republicans with this memo and these kinds of tactics, right?
Might work.
Right. In some ways, for all the ridicule heaped on him, he has some understanding of the electorate. Throw them what they like. It's like a TV show. It's like every hit TV show gives you the same storyline every week because that's what you tune in to see. And that's what he's doing politically. He's giving you what you want. He's giving you the show you're looking for. And even with what you're saying, that probably is pretty effective.
Pro wrestling.
Right? I mean, isn't that true?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little demoralized here. I like the talk about ideals and democratic institutions, but we seem to be someplace else at the moment.
Well, then the question is, how do you get beyond that or beyond that partisan moment, not moment, partisan era we're in, if this is the direction it goes, just kind of ripping down trust in institutions?
I think the short answer is lose in November, get the military to say something.
I think that's probably true. You know, the other historic way is reform. So we've had two periods.
Well, okay, Gilded
that's
Age.
That's not going
right?
to happen.
So then if we're going to take the long arc going forward, it's going to be something we've talked about before. Like, for instance, when we talked with Richard White about the first Gilded Age, there is this question of a long arc forward in which is there some way out of our current political moment? And it's going to be something like, I don't know, the Republican Party splits in half, a reformist movement that goes where Democrats claim that they're going, and a genuine progressive movement that moves us forward. And then on some long arc, our children's generation gets something better. And so that's sort of a second progressive era. So that's the arc going forward.
And added to that has to be some of the other things you've talked about, like how districts are shaped.
Yeah.
Concrete reforms. That was the answer in the 70s. It wasn't simply a new generation came into Congress post-Watergate. We actually tried to reform the way the rules worked, from sunshine laws to ethic rules to campaign finance. Nothing's aligned for that to happen now.
Yeah. So one nice thing about the gerrymandering question is that it's something where both parties can come together and either party can say, look, that hurt me.
Yeah.
And so that's an example where even though the Democrats are the ones who are up in arms about it, one could easily imagine the parties coming together on that.
Yeah.
And so that's a relatively bright spot.
Do you think the gerrymandering, since we spoke last and since the decisions now about Pennsylvania, the districts, that the redistricting can move forward? Are we really seeing the momentum you've been hoping for?
Oh, yeah. Things are moving forward.
You're optimistic.
I think Pennsylvania is going to be redrawn at this point. I mean, it would take some pretty weird events for it not to happen. Pennsylvania is going to be redrawn in time for November. These other states.
Let me stop you there. So what's going to happen? All right. So it's redrawn for November. What will the effect be on elections there someone who doesn't understand?
So there's 18 congressional districts in Pennsylvania. Currently, six of them are open. Six of them were considered to be leaning Republican, but under the current political climate, were certainly under threat of incumbents losing their seats. Broadly speaking, the thing that is certain to happen, I think, with the redrawing is that the majority of seats in Pennsylvania will become more effective, more competitive. So that's certain to happen.
A majority of them.
I think most seats in Pennsylvania are going to become more competitive.
And will that include seats where Democrats have?
It will certainly make Democrats.
That's the ideal.
So that's
nonpartisan.
That is very likely to happen because the gerrymander that was there was drawn to make safe seats for both sides and to really cram Democrats into a few districts. And so anything like a monkey could draw districts with like, you know, a ruler or whatever. I guess monkeys don't really use rulers. But anyway, but, you know, like
if they
like,
did,
like any kind of
according to the Republican memo, they do
any kind of simplification yeah. is going to make the districts more competitive. Mm-hmm. Now, it happens to be that it's a pretty bad wave year for the working against the Republicans. And so, yeah. you know, there may be lesser gains than one would see under normal circumstances. And so, you know, there are people who analysts who would argue with me that it was going to be a bad year for the Republicans anyway. But, you know, you take away their levy.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's what a gerrymander is. You take away the levy and, OK, that's definitely going to be a bad year. If you lose your levy, then you're going to get flooded. And so I would say that at this point, ballpark, it's going to be a gain of that delegation is currently 13 Republicans, 5 Democrats. Well, I mean, there's one vacancy. But anyway, up until a few months ago, it was 13-5. And, you know, it wouldn't be real surprising for that delegation to go 9-9.
9-9.
Yeah, that would not be a surprising outcome or
and,
even, you know.
And what other states do you think we're going to see this in for 2018? Is there any there it's clear to?
Probably not, just because the wheels of justice turn pretty slowly.
Okay.
And so in Maryland and in North Carolina,
right. it won't.
Probably not. You know, could happen. But I think that defendants in those cases are going to make an argument that it would be too disruptive. If I were to guess, I would say maybe Maryland could be redrawn, although that was a gain for Republicans
yeah.
of one seat. And then in North Carolina, yeah, I think that the Republicans down there are going to be able to run out the clock and just make an argument saying, oh, golly, it's just going to be too disruptive. And
yeah.
so I'd lean towards being surprised if the lines got redrawn in time for this year.
But it sounds to me, even though earlier I depressed you, that
yes.
with this part of government, this institution of how our elections work, you see some glimmers of hope coming from the courts, that there is interest and enthusiasm and support for making sure our institutions are strong.
I think so. I mean, you know,
is that fair to
my,
say?
My enthusiasm may fade in a year or so, but right now it's a good time to be buying futures in fair
districts. It's kind of amazing though. Why is it why is that taking shape? Why are people supporting I guess it's the courts, but there are people working on this.
Well,
why is this issue gaining traction?
I think it started 5 years ago when Democrats noticed that they got hosed by redistricting, and then it's been a slow buildup. And I think that, you know, honestly—
So there's a partisan origin to
partisan,
the interest.
Yeah, partisan origin, but then I think it's starting to be recognized as a bipartisan offense. Anthony Kennedy is in good cardiac health as far as anybody can tell.
Yeah.
And he's looking like he's going to be on the court for at least another year. So he's going to lay this down this year. Looks like he's going to stick around for next year. And you know, there's even a possibility, I wouldn't bet on it, but there's a possibility that Chief Justice Roberts is going to go along with it because now that there's one Republican and one Democratic gerrymander before the court, he might be satisfied that that it's something that could be ruled upon. So, you know, I think that a lot of it emanates from the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about distrust in institutions.
And voter initiatives, right? Because there's one in Michigan, one in Ohio at this point. So there's voter initiatives.
We've talked about distrust in institutions. We've talked about this new idea of whatever politics in the modern polarized era that President Trump has discovered. You can do almost anything and nothing happens. And finally, a glimmer of hope or of optimism from Sam about this move on redistricting, not simply the political effects, but back to our theme, the positive institutional effects of improving at least the way our elections work. That's the potential here.
It's a relative bright spot. It seems like it's, you know, things are trending in the right direction. It's going to take a lot of work. A lot of citizens are going to have to keep on working at the state level. But, you know, it's a relative good direction in where things are headed.
All right. Well, we're going to see by the time we record the next episode how you're feeling and what happens. But that wraps up our episode. So once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And so thanks, everyone, for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.